Hello, is Erica, Cleveland, and Darlene there?
Yeah, Darlene's here.
Hi, this is Marlene.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good, good.
Good.
Are we the only two on the line?
I think so.
Oh. We're the early bird.
Yeah. You were on for the full session last week?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there last week. I had sent you an email about I was there because I really couldn't hear anything. It was like broken and faded and it was going in and out.
That's what I experienced too, Marlene. It was terrible.
Yeah, so hopefully it'll be different tonight so that it will be less strenuous to hear and get to hear everything.
Because it's a lot of information. It's really a lot of information.
Yeah, it's very concentrated, very dense. There's like no fluff to it. It's like really concentrated.
Yes.
Yeah, and I had a couple of questions. I know there were like some duplications of information. I don't know if you noticed that. And then there were some grammar and spelling that kind of threw me. But then I realized that I would just make the correction on my own. But tonight, I'm assuming we're doing Module 1.
I thought we're going to do module 2.
Hey, this is Dave. I wanted to sign on early in case anybody wanted to start some good gossip or have discussion or ask questions. How are you guys doing?
Hi, Dave.
Good.
How are you?
Welcome. Hey, thanks for the kind words and the responses from the emails. I wanted to see if there are things that would be helpful for us to clarify or talk about or questions that you have about any of the material in the first seminar or anything you want to be sure that we cover in subsequent ones.
Dave, are we doing Module 1 tonight or Module 2?
We're beginning the Module 1. We're going to do the first three steps of the roadmap. Last seminar we did the story, the idea of story, and the remaining three seminars we're going to cover the seven steps of the roadmap system.
Okay.
And there's in your outline you'll see an idea of what's covered, it's a fairly annotated outline so you don't have to take notes.
And then yeah, it is.
What it corresponds with in the workbook. Okay.
I hope I can hear you better tonight because last week was really difficult to hear you.
Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going through a whole transition from computer to telephone and headset.
Yeah.
So thank you for the feedback. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Well, who else? What you got? How are you hearing this material? Some of you, I know, on the call will be hearing it not for the first time, and some of you it'll be an initial exposure. I'm interested in any responses you have and questions you have about it. As a preparation for what we're going to be doing, what we're going to be beginning in this seminar, how many of you know how to read or write code for your computer? Anyone?
No.
Well, all right then. We're about to learn to read and write code for mind and brain. And the roadmap is seven-step process of deconstructing a story and reconstructing a revised or a new one. It's a systematic way of understanding and creating stepwise change, integrating psychology and neuroscience with strategic coaching. Now, our focus is on a wellness story, but think about how this could be on a life story, career story, money, relationship, other kinds of stories. We're going to focus on wellness, but it's applicable to other aspects of what someone's doing, because we're looking at some of the fundamental things. Remember, we talked about the operating system that we each have. 90 to 95% of that is unconscious. So many of the algorithms are not consciously in focus, yet we operate on them all the time. We create behavior patterns, emotional reactions, attachment patterns based on the fundamental algorithms that we have. And how do you listen to the client's story to begin to understand that together to create a new one? That's exactly what we're going to be talking about. This is really just to inform your listening, to begin to think about how you're listening, how you're understanding, how you can collaborate with a client to begin to co-create a new or revised story. So that's the master plan here. Other thoughts or questions before we begin our more formal material?
Hey, David.
Yes, this is.
Good evening. This is Tatiana. I just got in, I think, maybe a minute late. I don't know. I have a question. I think the last week that we met, you mentioned you may be emailing the group, but I don't think I received anything.
When did you register for the...
When did I register?
Yeah.
I registered quite some time ago, so it was way before the class started.
Okay. I don't see your name on the list I've given by CTA. You registered through CTA, right?
Right. Tatiana Searing, you don't see my name?
No, I don't. Oh, yes, I do. I sure do. I do now, yes.
Okay.
I will resend the – it's just a reminder because you've already gotten – the page that has the outline and has the four ports for the playback, and it has the download for both the outline and the workbook. You got that when you registered.
Right.
I sent that around again as a reminder.
I see.
Have you gotten either one of those?
Oh, I've got the one from CTA with, the link to the workbook and the initial one on how to connect in the call. Yeah. Okay.
That's where playback is. That's the download for the outline and the workbook. So you have everything. You got everything I got.
All right. Okay. Thank you for confirming.
Yeah, thanks for checking, though. Any other questions, any other housekeeping things that might be helpful, or questions about the material or anything that we've discussed so far? Well, if not, I'll move into the material, and that means we'll have some time at the end for discussion. So if you have questions or anything you would like to talk about, sure, jot it down, and we'll preserve some time. Okay, we're going to talk about the beginning of the roadmap process. We've discussed the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. We're going to look closely now at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change. We're going to look at the seven steps of the roadmap, the acronym is roadmap process, to create a new wellness story. And these are the seven steps. You have them in your outline. Recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map the wellness strategies, author new experiences, and very importantly, program new wellness experiences and identity. each step is simple, but it's not necessarily easy. The actual implementation of the ideas can be difficult because it often requires us to change the way we think about what we do. And think about how, as we talked last time, every client you work with, they're not telling you their story. They're telling you the way it is. You don't have a story. You have the way you're living your life. So story is the metaphor that we're using to understand and put together some things to be able to make it more accessible and amenable to change. So think about how we are challenged by breaking bad or outdated habits, developing new ones, remaining disciplined over the long haul. So the first three steps in the roadmap are about awareness, a systematic way to ask questions of yourself or your client. So think about it for yourself first as we go through this. Then I think it will make much more sense to you and you'll find an application. The very best thing that we can do to prepare to work with our clients is to really understand our story quite well. And then we're in a better position to facilitate our client understanding theirs. So first step, recognize authorship of your wellness story. Remember the premise. Each moment, we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Every day begins a new page. The dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us, they're created by us. Yet so often the story closest to us, our own, is the most difficult to know. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past, to end an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new, or at least revised, story. To really learn something, to make it a memory, to make it active, you have to put it in the output channel. Passive learning is not enough. So, how can we tell our life and wellness stories to ourselves in order to know which aspects work and which need to change? I think there are four principles in recognizing authorship. First principle, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Our beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and our results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior, and we are not always aware of our beliefs and our assumptions. Our beliefs ghostwrite our stories, so it's helpful to know them, and it's helpful to be able to listen for them in ourselves and in others. Here's a brief story just to illustrate. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a very small space. The trainer ties a rope around his leg, stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to break the rope, but the rope is strong and it can't. The baby elephant stays in the area determined by the very short length of the rope. Now, fast forward, this elephant grows to a mammoth adult size, 6 to 7 tons. It could easily break that same rope, but it doesn't, because earlier as a baby, it couldn't. This 6-ton adult elephant is constrained by the assumption based on earlier experiences. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that determines his behavior. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. We're going to come back to each of these. Second principle, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select and register and process. We construct our storylines from these premises. We have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to assess if in present time they're working. Because so much of our software, so much of our unconscious operating system is software that was constructed and honed at an earlier time. Now, for most of it, it operates on a default mode, it takes no energy, and it makes us very efficient. But there are times that this software has become outdated, and we continue to do the same thing and get the same results, but it's no longer working. Maybe as it once did, maybe as it never did. So, that's why we have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus. We don't get what we want, we get what we expect. Neuroscience and quantum physics shows us how we get what we focus on. And we always make our beliefs come true. We act in such a way to teach people how to respond to us, because this then actualizes our beliefs and validates our assumptions. It becomes internally consistent. Third principle. A new story can only occur by living in the present moment. Social scientists discovered that when you measure people's intentions, you can affect their behavior. When people, for example, are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer. If you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of they're going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? The question increased purchase rates 35% over the next 4 months. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking if people intend to eat certain foods, to eat more nutritionally, to work out more regularly. So, stating intentions and being specific about them create the desire to follow through on what we commit to verbally. We want to be consistent with what we've talked about, especially out loud, that we're going to do. That's why you ask a client at the end of the coaching session something like, from what we've talked about today, what do you want to plan to do in the next week before we meet again to get some traction on? And then if the client says, well, I know I need to, I should, I ought to, what? We want to be sure that's a commitment. What will you do? What do you commit to do? So, state your intentions. Be specific. Write them down. Get a witness or an accountability partner. You are that for your clients. The stated intention is way more powerful when it's coupled with a specific action plan. Principle 4. Our minds seek closure and infer causality whether or not it's accurate. A number of research findings illustrate that we find something to make sense of what we perceive, even if it's not cause and effect. These findings suggest that people can be unaware of the reason that they do what they do, but when they're asked for reasons, they readily give one. I'm going to give some examples as we get into some material here. So to create a complete story infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. Complete trumps accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that can bring closure without ownership or growth. It's like a finish without an ending. I want to highlight here on the workbook, page 1.5, review the exercise in step 1, recognize authorship of your story. And it spells out what we've talked about. The plot is really the core themes or storylines of life story. This is the wide-angle lens. The storylines. Your wellness story is your self-statement. And this is where we can use a close-up lens. Whatever you think and feel and experience, you create each moment. Whatever you experience, you either create or you agree to. So, I'd suggest that you complete each exercise in step 1 before you move to the exercises in step 2. Now, here's step 2. To own your story, look especially at the exercise assumptions and motivations constructing storylines. It may help you to illuminate some of the things that have just been automatic, that have just been a default mode. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we already process daily, like adding a new diet or adding a health club membership, is likely not going to have an impact unless you change the software, unless you change how you see and process things. As we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that I think might be helpful. And think about this as you're listening to clients. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So if someone is having performance that they're not liking or that they feel is compromised, look at the antecedent. Look at the behavior, because the behavior is driving that performance. Look at what behavior is adaptive, success-oriented, optimal, and whatever is not, whatever is compromised or not in the very best interest, look at the beliefs that precede that. The beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. Here are a couple of examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to exercise 6 days a week. Limiting beliefs, even though they may not be conscious, also influence reality and behavior. Limiting beliefs have an effect emotionally and physically. Well, I just can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. My opinion doesn't matter. Notice that these examples include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. First, you have to experience what you do as a choice rather than this is just the way things are. So this is about recognizing authorship and owning your story, owning that what you do is exactly what you determine. And again, a fundamental precept of this step, owning your story, is whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Let's apply that notion by talking about point of reference and active versus passive. First, the point of reference. A point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. They may subtly transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. Here are some typical characteristics of those with an external point of reference. Another way to say this, here's a list of a bunch of coachable moments. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. This is why, again, I have an agreement with every client I work with in mentor coaching that I can interrupt them at any point that I feel it might be helpful for us to look at something, and I give them permission to interrupt me. Because whenever somebody says this, I don't think the rest of the paragraph is going to illuminate it further. It's right there. Another, they're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating. Well, you know, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. Some of these are way too easy for me to say, by the way. When they experience a symptom in their bodies, they medicate it away. And again, that's like turning off the light on the dash of your car. Now, contrast that with those with an internal point of reference. This is what we coach toward. Those with an internal point of reference see their authority as their own. They realize they're writing their own story, and it's not there until they write it. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility. Their theme then becomes one of effectiveness. They know that, at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. Here are some characteristics. They recognize accountability for their lives. They're proactive. They plan. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated the result and then look for alternatives. If they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. And again, think about how actively with each of these, we're working with clients to help them in a collaborative way. They decide what to change and initiate that change. Now, this is going to take some nudging sometimes by you, the coach. They realize that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, here's a related notion: to recognize active versus passive positions. And this is one of the things that I think is important to recognize how you're listening to someone. I believe you can get more information dealing with people by doing your mentor coaching by telephone than you can in person. You don't have the distractibility, and especially if you learn how to listen to their conversation, how they construct their phrases, their words, how they construct their story. This is an example, because sometimes it's like the story just seems to write itself. It just happened. Well, I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. Now, again, every one of these is a coachable moment because someone actively creates their structure each day. My thoughts run away from me. Well, this just seems to keep happening. So remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. So, once recognizing and owning your wellness story, first two steps, step three, assess the storylines and plot. By recognizing it and owning it, then you can assess it to see each of the components and is it working? Is it working all together? So, there are a couple of exercises that I tend to give a number of my new clients. I want them to do these two exercises to distinguish and address ideals and distinguish and address needs. And this is in the workbook beginning page 1.12 and 1.14. Because needs and ideals are at the core of identity. It's part of the foundation of self. Ideals are kind of an internal compass, a personal model of value, an internal guide to purpose. So what this means is that the only place I know self-esteem comes from is from having internal ideals and living up to them. Shame comes from not living up to internal ideals. Needs are important because when someone is meeting their own needs, they do this in a self-reflective and self-nurturing way. So this is important, I think, and for anything I write down in a client's chart, I do the top three needs and the top three ideals inside the folder because I want that as a reference for both of us to have when we're looking at strategies and goals. I want to be sure they fit. And there's an example in the workbook of a non-fit and how that can be addressed. Because when needs and ideals are aligned with strategies and goals, that's dynamite. All of somebody's going in the same direction. Now, another part of the assessment of a wellness story to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. If you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's simply a theory or a frame of reference. It's just the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. And I touched last time on what we now know from neuroscience in terms of the way the brain works is that we see a situation or have a prompt and we boot up a mindset to deal with it. It's kind of like booting up a Google map. So it's a series of experiences like this. So what we need to be sure is that we have a cohesive story, a narrative that puts all of these various mindsets in perspective and makes a cohesive story with a beginning, middle, and end. So with the right map, planning, and strategy can make a huge difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines, and we're often not aware of having them. We just assume we see things the way they are. And the brain has a mind of its own, and we are often of two or more minds. The prefrontal cortex says, well, let's set up an exercise program and plan a retirement savings account. The limbic system says, let's have that cheesecake and order the big screen HD TV. Each struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. And one of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness. This is often what we help our clients do, is to develop self-awareness, to develop self-reflection. A couple of articles not too long ago in Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review said that the premier quality of successful executives is their ability to be self-reflective and self-aware. Now, I would say that for everybody. They just happen to be looking at executives. So this is one of the unique qualities we have, is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means that we can learn from our experiences and from the experiences of others. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things and reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. So, in your wellness story, is all of you going in the same direction? Do all the storylines of your wellness story advance the plot? Listen to your self-statements. What we say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of our beliefs and personal realities. Whatever you attribute to others, another person, group, or culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. We always perceive and create outside to match inside. So pay attention to what you consistently like and dislike in another. Don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. I recently saw this put very succinctly that I'm seeing a lot at the national level. Immediately accuse your enemy of what you're most guilty of. So listen for repetitions of the old story. Recognizing and owning your story is necessary. It's a prerequisite to assessing change. Remember this. Whatever remains unconscious is going to be attributed to fate. You're always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious. So it's helpful to know exactly what they are to see if they're what you want them to be. For example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self like overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. And we'll talk more about the art and science of how to structure a visualization, and there's a visualization exercise in the addendum. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you know you're not going to do it. You know if somebody says, well, I'm going to try to stop drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of somebody not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction, by not being totally committed, by creating an out. When somebody says, I will, they have stated a commitment. And then build in accountability by asking, by when? Or smart goals wouldn't have a T on the end. We'll get to SMART goals in a bit. So listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. You sense it and feel it when you eat healthily, work out, rest well, at the time, especially later. You know, a huge, delicious dessert is going to taste great at the moment, but the residual feeling and awareness of regret will last far longer in time than the immediate pleasure of the great taste. I mean, think about how many times have you really felt good about yourself when you've exited an all-you-can-eat buffet. Also, reflect on what studies and your experience shows. Major taste impact up to 80% in the first 2 to 3 bites. After that, it's redundant. Your body's already accommodated to the sensation. Listen to your body. Acknowledge and accept its somatic language. Acknowledge what works and what doesn't. Hear your body speak when you eat too much. Eat foods that are unhealthy or drink too much. It's not rocket science. Your body is sensitive, accurate, immediate. Pay attention to the message when you work out, when you feel refreshed by taking care of yourself. Your body makes you accountable. A physical symptom contains the message, yet importantly, it is the message. Symptoms give disguised voice to what you avoid knowing. A symptom is a sentinel of a process that needs, begs to be understood, to be listened to rather than silenced, to be respected rather than disregarded. It's a storyline needing to be heard. A symptom repeats until it's translated. When you listen to whispers, no one needs to shout, especially your body. Somatic language is literal. A pain in the neck, purging something, churning gut, weeping skin, hypertension. A psychological symptom answers a question not asked consciously and proffers a story with its own history, dynamics, and meaning. Milrad Pavic said it very simply. It's easier to fall ill sometimes than learn the truth, so take care of your maladies. They always have something to tell you. You're the author, not the victim of your symptom. So, I didn't exactly plan this, but I want to move into step 4 to introduce some things so we'll have time for a little bit of expansion in some of the other areas later. So, we're going to talk about step 4, decide what to change. Now, here's a precept. Part of the struggle for people to embrace change is because the methods, so many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. That's why I emphasize so much in mentor coaching, really understanding the principles of the mind and brain. And I want to do that specifically now. So remember this principle from step 2. This is what we're going to expand on. In adulthood, at least, you either create your reality or agree to it. And for this, you have to recognize and own your wellness story. So let's look now at what's involved in deciding to change, this 4th step, to author new experience. Here's how the brain opposes change. This is crucial to understand when we engage change. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. The cognitive science inform us how to change a personal or a business story. So let's look at how the brain opposes change, because we can use this information to facilitate success. Number 1, how the brain opposes change. Change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact that's far more challenging than getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that were repeated that have become habits are hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages of our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. So, basically, we don't have to think about how you drive the same way to work each day. Because of this default mode, we can think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is energy efficient because it frees the brain up to do other things. When these habits, though, are confronted and have to change, then the basal ganglia in the midbrain, where the automatic pilots are, get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. Think about how disruptive it is. You've learned during the same way to work. You're listening to a book one day. Suddenly there's construction. You have to snake your way through a neighborhood. You have to pay attention. You can't listen to the book. It takes more energy. It's work to change. So the natural inclination is to resist the stress of change to preserve the default habit. The brain naturally resists change because to hardwire behavior saves energy. So it's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know it yet, so our minds and strategy have to lead the way. Ray Kurzweil said, I heard him say this in person. This is from his book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. He said, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. Number two, change creates dissonance. Now, couple this brain inclination to keep doing things with the same efficient routine and the mind's inclination to see what we expect to see. We see what we expect, what our radar has already been coded for. And we do this by screening information based on expectation as validation. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, our brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. This brain innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors, the difference between expectation and perceived actuality, registers as a sense that something's not quite right. This is an actual area in the brain that activates when something unusual or different happens. At times, it can be abrupt and explicit. Remember the experience of maybe absentmindedly going to the refrigerator, getting a drink of milk, and bam, you discover it was a sip of orange juice because you hadn't been paying attention. When this happens, neural firings disrupt expected flow and use brain energy. It's also the basis of why the news that bleeds leads and why there's rubbernecking, because this is something different. It's activating. Now, the good news, the brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors. In other words, to optimize behavior. This means that these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback or diminished rewards. So this means our brains respond to mistakes. So this is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or it's simply a neural response to change itself. Three, the brain is a prediction machine. I want to give you some numbers, if you have a pen or pencil. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. What's missing? Usually, may say 3 and 6, maybe multiple 3. Consider this, nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes we have to outsmart our brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, so the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. Extrapolation has been called the most common mistake in investing, when we predict the future based on the past. J. Paul Getty said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. So you see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of many jokes. Listing a couple of things, then a third non sequitur. Set up, payoff. So the human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. We need to be sure we predict, envision the right things. Number four, how the brain opposes change. Behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. What works better, threats or reinforcements? Well, the answer is neither one. Both will likely backfire because threats work short term. They draw attention away from work, back to the problems, and recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns associated with lateness. Remember, from quantum physics and neuroscience, we get what we focus on, not what we want. So if you focus on lateness or focus on anything, positive or negative, you're going to enhance it. Now, every one of you who is a parent knows this principle. Whatever you respond to, you're going to enhance. Whatever behavior you respond to, that behavior is going to enhance. So think about that in coaching. Now, we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Well, not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. This is also why telling people what to do is likely not to work. Five, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. Most of the professional athletes and actors I work with get up in the morning, they go to the gym, but they're not motivated to do it, but they do it because they know they need to do that in order to do what's next. You don't have to be motivated to do something. All you have to do is to have a plan and stick to it. Motivation is not essential. Waiting until you're motivated is just another form of waiting. A plan and sticking to it. Those are the only two things that are necessary. Six, emotions change brain functioning. Anxiety or fear shifts someone into a survival mode that prevents fluid learning and understanding. Alarm signals of fear, anxiety, anger, even just irritability and impatience can shanghai the attention of the frontal lobes and cause forfeiting optimum function. When emotions are triggered, brain chemicals are released that prompt action and away from creativity and assess knowledge. This is why one of the first steps needs to be regulating a state of mind. We're going to come back to that and devote some time to that. Seven, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. But for longer periods of time, especially a few hours or more, learning capacity declines. So with sustained stress, people can make bad and even emotionally charged decisions. So this is also why regulation of states of mind and management of emotion is foremost in the benefits that we can bring. Under stress, we do two things. We regress to an earlier mode. We boot up a state of mind that's like tripping and falling in a time capsule. And then we hyperfocus on the most recent emotional events, and both of which lose the big picture. So number eight, how the brain opposes change, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place and one position can get most entrenched. So this is one of our challenges as coaches, to open a closed system, to simply be a perturbator, to empathically challenge, to strategically perturbate something that seems like, well, this is just the way things are. This is the story. These last two principles now, I think, are absolutely huge for coaching. Nine, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis, new brain cells, enriched environment and exercise. And think about enriched environment. That's what we do as coaches. Intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. We co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bus, nudge. Here's how that works. The hippocampus is part of the brain, midbrain, specifically connected with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. With exercise, the number of cells in the hippocampus increases by almost 100%. Remember, the hippocampus, the site of creativity and memory. And recently these findings were replicated in non-invasive studies in humans in London taxicab drivers and medical students at the University of Hamburg. And another related finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus decrease with stress, so creativity and memory decrease. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region in the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. For example, the traditional treatment for stroke patients was to have a dysfunctional arm placed in a sling so that they didn't damage it. The therapy that put the functional arm in a sling, requiring them to use increasingly the dysfunctional arm, after 10 days of therapy, patients regained significant use of an arm they thought would otherwise hang useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. Another example, not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims can be changed depending on use. For example, an expert braille reader has a significantly greater area and the finger reading braille than someone who doesn't. Same for classical guitarists. So the good news here, we are not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways and new neural networks are formed. In other words, new highways to new communities in your brain. And some remarkable new research shows consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. So here's a summary of what neuroscience teaches us about change to apply to your wellness story. This is a reiteration and a summary. One, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge, though, can be the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. In other words, a belief, a fact, is an anatomical reality in your brain. You can't simply remove it or easily override it by placing another fact there. But change and transformation can occur. It's an inside job, and it's an inside job done best with mentor coaches. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. This is why fixing doesn't work. You can't just list four reasons and ideas wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network. Four, partly because it's complex and partly because it's subjective reality, I guess that's kind of redundant, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. And since prior knowledge is concrete, an actual pathway in the brain, an anatomical reality, we have to begin with where someone is to really solidly understand their story in order to see what to change. So here are, in short summary form, some specific ways to facilitate a change of mind and brain. Begin where the client is. Help them learn more about what they already know, their story, that they're just operating in a default way. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks, natural talents, behaviors, patterns, to encourage their practice. Remember, from coaching, the the fundament. You can't get any more basic than this. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. People won't pay you for that, believe it or not. Four, don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching. Remember, we get what we focus on. So it should be on useful habits, to refocus, to reframe. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Six, let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. Seven, encourage the clients to develop their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, metaphors, each create maps. Eight, the brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. It's self-rewarding in that way. The aha experience that lights up three different parts of the brain and vaults into a different state of mind that is more synthetic, creative, integrative. Nine, you have to recognize and take ownership of your experience. 10, when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brain. And 11, give attention to a new experience or new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. And remember, a series of small, specific steps strategically planned is more effective than, say, a one-time intensive training, unless there's a follow-up program. So here's a simple example of that. Some penguins knew that they had a basic, innate capacity to fly, but none of them could fly. So they wanted to learn to fly. So they got together and hired a motivational coach. They went to an all-day seminar. They set SMART goals, visualized, wrote affirmation. After a few hours, one penguin sort of broke free and flew a short distance. Others were encouraged then. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event. Okay, we're in discussion mode now, if you dare. I'm interested in thoughts or comments or questions, clarifications about anything that we've talked about. How does this sound to you? How doable does it sound to you?
This is Kip.
Hey, Kip, how you doing, my man?
Hey, I'm doing fine.
I know you've heard just, this once before, at least.
Well, it's a lot. And I just was focusing on the neurogenesis and the hippocampal data that you threw out there. And it really is an astounding thing that with neuroplasticity and the neurogenesis that can happen with the enriched environment, the exercise, it's just hard to believe that we have that much power in our lives. And so it's, you know, I don't have as much a question as I'm just in awe of the creativity that's available to all of us. And that the old stories, that 95% you talked about, can just overwhelm, especially when the viscera and the emotions get involved. And so it's like I want to get out of that. I want to move past it. I want to break through the membranes. So I appreciate your ability to create the environment that's so enriched. And so I just was thinking about those things as you mentioned some of those points.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that, Kip. I think that really captures the essence of what I think is so powerful. And the thing that I'm emphasizing here is that even though 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious, we are still creating it. And it's not there until we create it, even though we may do it automatically. The algorithms that we operate on are understandable, the story components that we operate on. And the steps that we're talking about is simply one way to deconstruct this and to look at it, because we each have various kind of algorithms of emotion, of attachment patterns, of behavior patterns, and to look at these as active constructions mean that we then have an awareness of choice. And that's exactly what we do in coaching. That's the juncture, the focus of what is common to what we do in mentor coaching with every client. We are choice architects. We help someone look at the choice they make this moment, at now and next. That's exactly where we focus. And this is simply one informed way of doing this. And I'm evolving this model and looking at how we can even improve and revise this. I just read a book on algorithms and what we can learn in human behavior from algorithms to see if there's something. I mean, I do several books a week, but that one just happened to fit some of the things that we are talking about and the way we're talking about it now. So I think what Kip is reminding us of is so essential, that this is what we do as mentor coaches. So thanks. Other comments, questions, thoughts?
Hi, Dave. This is Kevin.
Hey, welcome. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And you?
Great.
I am fascinated by the somatic language. And one of my favorite quotes used to be, "I'm not trying to control my thoughts. I'm trying to not let my thoughts control me." And if I understand fully what I've been reading and what I'm saying is, we actually can control those somatic thoughts?
Well, I think you're talking about two things that are very related, but they're not the same. What messages we get from our body contain the message. They're the communication in and of itself. Whenever we have a churning gut, that's saying that there's something we're keeping at a level of our gut that is upsetting, that we're not allowing in our conscious mind to be able to deal with it perhaps more effectively, to integrate mind, body, and spirit to do that. That's where we come in as wellness coaches. If somebody's having a pain in the neck, then, I mean, the obvious question is, who is it? They're holding something that their body is expressing that they're not allowing in their conscious awareness. So this is especially why we're listening to all kinds of communication, how somebody constructs their stories, what their bodies are telling them that they may not be listening to, the whispers that they're not listening to, because the body is going to ultimately shout if you don't listen to it. So this is communication at all levels. Now, a related aspect, I think, of your question is there are going to be some thoughts like, you know, negative thoughts, ruminations, obsessions, things that continue to come into mind that it seems like we're not in charge of, and we get caught up or derailed in some negative thought or just negative thought loop, especially after an upsetting time or a hurt or something like that. And one simple way to think about that is to recognize that as quickly as it happens, that it's an error message from our brain, so that we use this to refocus on what we need to do, what's positive, what's adaptive, to refocus and to reframe it to look at what we do need to do instead of staying with that negative thought loop and being marooned in our left brain, which is, you know, the thought being, negative thought being over and over again. That can happen just as quickly as we get upset about something and we get marooned in our right brain. Our right brain takes the left brain and holds it hostage, so we're caught up in emotion and that state change, and then we're captive of that state instead of feeling that we can get grounded and centered and move to an understanding and to an optimum response. Now, do both parts of that make sense in terms of what you heard in your question?
It did. Thank you very much. The yeah. second part in particular, I really appreciate that. And I love the treatment of thoughts as an error message from the brain. That's fantastic. Cheers.
Well, thank you all. I know we're out of time. If there are other questions, either jot them down and we'll begin there next time, or fire them off to me in an email and I'll put them on cue for us discussing at the beginning of next seminar. So thanks very, very much. I appreciate it, and I look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Bye now. Have a great
day. Bye, Dave.
Bye, Dave.